You're listening to The Big Table with me, Philip Limbury, and I'm here today at the Hay Festival, the Hay Literary Festival, famously described by Bill Clinton as the Woodstock of the mind. And I'm here today with my guest, Rosie Boycott, who is trustee of the Hay Literary Festival. She's also a journalist, a travel editor, and champion of healthy food. Rosie Boycott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Good morning. Lovely to be here. Yes, I've been at Hay all week, so very nice to stop and have a chat.
Tell me what Hay means to you. You're a trustee, you've been involved, you've been interviewed. You interviewed me very kindly when I was here with my first book, Farmageddon. What does Hay mean to you?
Well, Hay's an extraordinary invention, creation, call it what you will, that is now 31 years old. It began literally in the little school up in the village, which has now been rebuilt into a bigger school. But we began as a festival for books and for writers and for ideas. It was begun by Peter Florence's father. Peter is now the director of Hay and has been through all these years. And we were very much at the beginning of this, I think, real need among people to just meet people, get real, stand in front of their favourite authors, their favourite thinkers, and listen to them talk and have a chance to ask them questions. It's a very fundamental part, I think, of what we do, in that any talk you come to in Hay, the last 20 minutes or so are always set aside for the audience to interact with the writer, or the philosopher, the scientist, whoever it happens to be. There's also sort of book signings. There's also quite an open feeling and masses of conversations going on around the site. I mean, today we are really unrecognisable physically from what we were 31 years ago. We have a enormous tented site. We don't quite know, because it's free to come onto the site, but around about 250,000 people come. And I find it personally very moving and very awesome that I've just this morning been in a tent with about 800 people on a not terribly warm Tuesday morning, listening to incredibly inspiring educators talk about both the problems and the aspirations of children's education. But also in the course of today, I can listen to you talking about cheap meat. I'll be able to listen to Ruby Wax talking about mental health. I'll be able to listen to a whole range of subjects that are as wide as the world is wide. And yes, we have flourished. So for me personally, I didn't really do much of university. I've been coming to Hay for 25 years, and it is like my university.
You've had an extraordinary career as a journalist, as an editor, and you've also been a long-standing chair of London Food, particularly during the mayoral spell of Boris Johnson. So you've had a real track record in championing a better food culture in Britain. You know, tell me a little bit about that. What fires your passion for food?
I find food deeply fascinating, but I also find it an issue through which you can filter the way that the society works. I mean, that sounds an incredibly grandiloquent statement to make about the stuff we eat, but actually I think it is true that food is the greatest need of man. It is wonderful. It's part of a natural cycle. It's part of what we are. And yet, what's happened in the last 50, 60 years, really since the end of the Second World War, but mostly since about the 1970s, is that that system has been completely captured, co-opted, and taken over by greed, huge corporations, and multinationals. It has meant that pretty much no country in the world now can honestly say they have a proper food policy. We have a food system now across the world. We're 6.5 billion people. We have just over a third of those people are overweight or obese. That's a figure that's really rising. Around about a third are underfed. That figure is going down. And around about a third of us eat okay. So if you look at that in the whole, you have to say, this is the world's most important system, and it's a failure. It is failing two-thirds of people every day in some way or another. And so it leads you into looking, A, for the culprits, which, as I say, I believe are about the way that in the post-war years, people started to realize they could produce increasingly cheaper food by sourcing the world, by cutting down rainforests, by factory farming animals, particularly chicken, pigs, cattle, by absolutely flagrant and irresponsible use of antibiotics through the food chain to order ensure that you could actually grow a chicken on an A4 piece of paper in 28 days, and to hell with the consequence for the chicken and essentially for human life as well. You know, we're looking now in this country and in other countries at the first generation that is not going to live as long as its parents. We're also looking at massive issues of inequality. I mean, you know, now research is showing us that kids that don't eat well don't do as well at school. Kids that, say, during the holidays, because their parents, they're on free school meals, if they don't get properly fed, they come back to school, they can't settle down, they don't work well for the first 2 or 3 weeks. That accumulates, and by the age of 10, they can have lost around about a year in academic achievement. This is just bad and shouldn't happen. And it frustrates me hugely that we have such a siloed approach to food, in that we have Department DEFRA, which is supposedly the Department of Food, Rural Affairs, Agriculture, and yet that looks after the kind of farming end of the business. And then we have the Department of Health that is picking up the consequence. Department of Education struggling in the middle to say, yes, OK, we'll give out 3 years of free school meals, but actually the standards are very badly enforced. But Department of Industry, DTI, etc., just looking at food companies and looking at them as exporters, how do we make more? And in the middle of that, you have the Treasury, who love the fact, and all governments do, that their populations have cheap food, because the arrival of cheap food in the 70s was really what allowed us to have the consumer economy. We went from spending around about 30% of our income on our weekly food bill, suddenly dropped to around about 10%. And that 20% was our flat screen tellies and our holidays in Mallorca. And nobody's want to go back on that. Yet we're stuck with this sort of nightmare. And we're stuck with the fact that it's an unsustainable situation. The planet is running out of soil. You know, we are facing tremendous issues of climate change, and we're facing tremendous health issues, all of which could start to be resolved if you change the food system. And I find it pretty dismaying still that when you look at Paris climate talks, that we're talking about clean air, we're talking about energy, food is still on the fringe.
What do you see as the opportunity for Brexit, for shaking things up in this country at least?
Well, in this country, certainly we have a huge opportunity and a huge liability. I mean, Brexit can be the moment where we reward farming in terms of its both production and its the willingness of farmers to caretake the landscape, to look after wildlife, to rear their animals holistically and sensibly, to maintain and increase our, you know, in terms of the world, our very high food standards. They aren't high enough for me, they're probably not high enough for you, but they are high terms of the world, ditto the environment standards. At the moment, all these have been sorted out in Brussels, are held by Brussels, and they're complicated. There's millions of them. Over the course of the last, 25 years, institutions like the Food Standards Agency have been run down, Environmental Agency. I know Michael Gove's talking about putting a new environment agency together with teeth. The big chance is that we do what the Secretary of State says, which is lead the world with our high standards. The fear is that trade defeats that, and we end up taking WTO rules and therefore permitting American exports. And if we do that kind of trade deal with America, which means their food can come in, then in a way everything that has been worked for goes out the window.
There are some people that would listen to you, Rosie, and say, well, you know,
does it matter?
And also, you know, Rosie's coming from a very metropolitan standpoint, you know, a London-based journalist, you know, working with Boris Johnson. What does she know? But actually, Rosie, you've had quite some experience of running a farm yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about that? You know, what insights have you gained from essentially being a farmer?
Well, I'm not a farmer now, but I have been, and I do spend a lot of time talking to farmers. And I think that all farmers agree that step back one sec. If you look at the size of the overall food industry in Britain, the actual farmer, the producer, gets 8.7% of that total bill. And yet the farmer, the grower, the producer, is the guy or woman who takes all the risks. I mean, you look at a winter like this, we had incredibly cold till very late. That's going to, from a point of view of an animal breeder, you have to have fed your cattle for longer. That's just a cost you didn't know you were going to have. From a point of view of growers, things are going to be later. So, you know, they're taking the risk. But higher up the chain, doesn't matter, whatever. And the cost that you get at the farm gate is incredibly small. If we had a different kind of localization, different way of feeding through, shorter food chains, shorter supply lines, more money would get back. And then that would make it more easy to be a farmer today.
And tell me a little bit about the farm that you were running and your relationship with the farm animals.
Well, I was very passionate about my pigs. At one point, I had 150 pigs. We would play football with them. They lived in a wood, or actually several woods by the end of it. They had a caravan, which they all crashed into and tore apart. But I have some priceless pictures somewhere of all the pigs looking out of the caravan windows. I became devoted to them all. I mean, you realise they had incredible characters and terribly smart, and they could figure things out. And I always used to say, you know, if Britain factory farmed Labradors, whole country would stop. You know, people would be hung, drawn and quartered. But we are quite happy to factory farm an animal that is just as intelligent, if not more so, with just as much character, loyalty and fun as any Labrador or dog. So we're very, very hypocritical about how we treat our animals. We're absolutely prepared to turn a blind eye. And I think producers are very duplicitous. Well, they always are. I mean, you know, you pick up a packet of sausages in the supermarket and there's a nice photograph of a kind of pig leaning on a farm gate or a farmer in the sunset. And, you know, you're kind of, we want to not believe. I mean, it's very interesting when you look, I think, at meat production overall, that in the 1970s there was a very concerted effort by the big meat producers to distance people from meat. So the kind of ideas of how McDonald's and people like that sold McNuggets, you know, Kentucky Fried, all these things, somehow the chicken or the live animal behind it got further and further and further away, until it's really extremely understandable why some kids, or humans, I mean, just don't connect the burger to a beef lot, and that they'd be horrified if they knew. I think they really would be horrified.
I think you're right, and you know, one of the things that we're pushing for is honest labelling. That's a campaign by Compassion in World Farming, which we run in conjunction with Soil Association, the RSPCA, and many others too. And we really want to see milk and meat labelled according to how it's produced. So if it's intensively produced, it indoor produced, it should say so. If it's free range or organic, then of course it should say so. But by mandatory requirement rather than just some voluntary code, which means that the bad stuff manages to masquerade on the shelves under terms like fresh or farm fresh or country fresh, which to me seems a travesty. I mean, to turn things around, to really get people engaged with their food, where it comes from, the animal welfare aspects of it, and to really see a surge in compassionate consumerism. What do you think that's going to take? What will it take to turn things around?
Well, I think, first of all, the government has to stand up to the industry. I mean, right across the board. I mean, at the moment, you know, we still farm in the same way that we've been farming since the war, which is about big scale, achieve it by whatever means, a farming system that is dominated by people who make big machinery and people who make big chemicals. I mean, someone was telling me the other day about, you know, in terms of the stupidity of some of our subsidies, about a big landowner who got $120,000 a year from Brussels as a subsidy, but his bill on pesticides and insecticides is now topping $200,000. So even with subsidy, he's sort of, you know, in a loss. And so if the government starts to change that subsidy, change that 120,000 quid, which they are going to, and say that actually you're only going to get money if you produce a much wider range of effects. If they start to see that farming has to change and that local has its importance. I mean, up in Preston, they have made a decision in the council to spend all their money on local produce. So everything that's going into the schools, the various procurement deals that they can control, is sourced within like 50 miles. And so every pound's going round, and actually it's doing incredibly well. So these are models that the government can help. For instance, we have only, God, I can't remember the number, but, you know, we've lost almost all our local abattoirs. And, you know, at the rate we're going, we're heading towards one giant abattoir in Birmingham to which all these animals have to be taken. If we, they could help put back the local abattoir, so you don't have to go more than 10 miles, and it's civilised, and it's nice, and it's as nice as it can be. It conforms to good rules. You could also start to really subsidise the growth of vegetables, looking at vegetable diets. But the thing is, if we don't put that stuff back into the diet, then, you know, it's not anyone's fault that people end up eating rubbish. And on the whole, rubbish comes from rubbish. And we continue a race to the bottom where the motivating factor is sell more made from ever cheaper ingredients.
I think one of the things which has been very surprising, very encouraging, has been the words that Michael Gove has been saying on these issues. To me, it seems like a complete turnaround. For 30 years, I've been used to banging my head on the brick wall outside DEFRA, almost a department that seems to have been in the pockets of the Industrial Farming Union. But now we have someone who is talking about rearranging the subsidy system so that public money is given to public goods, and public goods being better environmental, better animal welfare. And how hopeful are you of us now looking at a new era where we can see some of these wrongs in the countryside actually turned around? How hopeful are you?
Well, I think one has to be hopeful. I mean, I don't know what more one can say, because this is politics. It doesn't always pan out. Certainly, Michael Gove is saying the right stuff. So we just have to keep our fingers crossed that he will see that through, despite lobbying pressure, despite pressure to have open trade deals with the USA.
To listeners of the Big Table, to supporters of Compassion in World Farming, what would be your message?
Well, I suspect it's much the same as yours. You know, support local, look at the labels, shop ethically, eat more vegetables, always, start replacing a certain amount of meat. You can do it. You can just eat slightly less meat of higher quality. Much better for you, much better for the planet. And also realise that, you know, food is amazing stuff. It connects everybody. It's about joy and celebration, but it can also be about dirty secrets and hardship. And if we all ate right, the world would be better.
And as you're in your day job as a travel editor, I mean, have you seen the harms of factory farming?
Well, I was in Malaysia at Easter and just driving through endless miles of palm oil, where once there would have been healthy, fabulous, thick jungle full of animals and birds and insects and different species and different fauna and flora. And it was a monotonous pile of palm oil trees as far as the eye could see. We went around 100 miles through palm oil fields, and that is extraordinary. It's devastation, and there's almost no wildlife around. I didn't see any birds, and that's extraordinary. You know, you're right in the middle of the tropics in an area where everything in the world will grow, and this has just been ripped up for the sake of cheap food.
Yeah, I know. Having been out in Sumatra and seen the palm industry out there, that this is not only for oil and those kind of things, for the processed food industry.
It's the glue that keeps all the stuff together.
It is. And what I've also discovered, and I'll be talking about this later on this afternoon, is that also palm products are finding their way into animal feed, particularly to feed factory-farmed cattle in Europe and here in Britain. So it's becoming ever clearer that our hunger for cheap meat is having devastation, not only on our local environment, but on the environment on other continents. And Rosie, just to sum up, what would you like to see happen in the next 12 months to really put our food system onto a much more sustainable course?
Well, firstly, from a UK point of view, I would like to see that when we exit the European Union, that we go with our standards of food maintained and that we really do keep them and stand up to them and say they are sacred. On a worldwide level, I would like to see food in the climate talks at exactly the same level that energy and oil has been, because there has been a difference there. Countries have been made to step up to the plate to get to targets, and look what's happened. You have China powering an industry of alternative energy, Hay Festival, we've only got electric cars here this year. I mean, you know, it's changing, and it's changing really fast, and people are finding they can make money and square these difficult circles. We can do the same with food. I mean, once I think the world realises its impact both on climate, soil, planetary health, our health, then that will start to move it. But it's got a way to go.
Rosie, a privilege talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip, and I'm looking forward to your talk this afternoon.